This chapter from The Spirituality of the Christian East by Thomas Spidlick is of very great interest because it supplies answers to some of the questions that are probably aroused whenever one hears in a general way about the physical technique of the hesychasts of the 14th century and then their later application in the modern hesychastic revival. These techniques are described in a very general way in Bishop Kalistos' articles, and citations are given here of rather more specific techniques, which we will probably find of interest, although I suspect we may not find them very congenial. To some extent, they're rather primitive in their physiology and even in their recommendations, but they give one a sense of how this form of prayer was very closely linked to the body and to experiences of the body. Another element that Father Spidlick highlights, which is often not much commented on elsewhere, is the question he raises in the first part of the text that I've given in this section, and that is the question whether the Jesus Prayer can replace other prayers, whether it can be a substitution for canonical prayers. This is of very great interest to us because, as we've seen in our discussion of the Rosary, that is part of the origin of the Rosary. The initial desire in the late Middle Ages, rather in the early Middle Ages, to allow those for whom psalmody was not a very reasonable possibility or an option to instead substitute multiple repetitions of the Our Father, and in some instances repetitions of the Hail Mary. Then the description of St. Albert by his biographer as one who both prayed the Hail Mary multiple times and associated with this with prostrations. As we will see, that's very related to, very analogous to, what one finds in prescriptions in regard to the Jesus Prayer. Father Spidlick, in the first section of the text that I've given you, points to a number of sources, especially Theophan the Recluse, who is a 19th century author and popularizer of the Philokalia, one who translated that text into Russian, and who is also a very great spiritual writer himself, suggests that it is primarily a complement and that it is not normally supposed to replace other prayers fixed by rule or by what in the West would be regarded as canonical obligation. But in fact, there may be circumstances in which it's permissible, particularly when one is unable to pray because of illness or because perhaps of psychological reasons or weariness. This kind of substitution might be acceptable or would be acceptable, associated primarily with prostrations, or for those who can't offer a full prostration on the ground, bowing over in the form of a matani. As we'll see, this is specifically mentioned in some of the texts that he also cites. If you drop down on the page, there are six examples from a text edited in Rome, but primarily for use by those of the Russian tradition, which specifically legislates the number of repetitions of the Jesus Prayer and the Matanias, or Matanis, profound bows, that can be used to substitute, under certain circumstances, an hour of the divine office. And although this is not in any sense the norm, it is recognized in these texts and elsewhere that this does happen, and it can be regarded as legitimate for those who practice the Jesus Prayer in a very regular way. It isn't that they are completely substituting the canonical office or the recitation of psalms for the Jesus Prayer, but under certain circumstances there might be a kind of ebbing and flowing between these practices in which the Jesus Prayer would not be interrupted, strictly speaking, for the sake of a canonical hour, but instead on some level would take its place. It's very important for us to realize that this question only arises in the context of those for whom liturgical prayer is the norm. And as we'll see, when we look at modern forms of monologistic prayer, particularly in the West, this is an important issue to bear in mind. The Jesus Prayer, as an apophatic prayer method, as a method that is intended to let go of images and words, makes sense in a liturgical tradition of the Christian East, where words and images constantly surround one. Bear in mind that in the Eastern Byzantine liturgy, one has far more text, many more litanies, many more repetitions of prayers. The liturgies go on two and sometimes three times longer than they do in the West. A celebration of the Eucharist can last for 2 or 3 hours depending on the particular solemnity of the occasion. And people can come and go during that celebration. So it makes perfect sense that in this kind of a tradition in which one is also literally surrounded by icons, all of the senses are being inundated in the most cataphatic, image-filled way imaginable. Images that you see before your eyes, the smell of the incense, the sound of the chanting, the participation in the liturgical prayers, it makes perfect sense that in a tradition where this is going on for hours and hours during the day, that you would occasionally have recourse to and maybe even substitute that for that experience something much more apophatic, something that is image-less, word-less, that uses a prayer directed to Jesus, using the name of Jesus as a way of letting go of images, letting go of words. And bear in mind that at the end of that process, one will enter back in to the liturgical rhythm of the Eastern Christian day, which will include all of that very cataphatic experience of faith. So the practice of the Jesus Prayer and this practice of substitution makes sense in a culture where you are constantly surrounded by a huge variety of images, by song, by text, by psalmody, which is much more lengthy than what one would find anywhere in the Christian West. And this is a point to which we need to return in our final discussion of the contemporary application of monologistic prayer. So here, the question of substitution only is comprehensible if one understands the context of the one who is raising the question, someone for whom their lives are constantly inundated by and informed by liturgical text, by psalmody, by an awareness of the liturgical year, by the cycle of the martyrs and the saints that is constantly constantly filtering through one's experience of prayer and a prayer in common in particular. The second section, if we drop down to it, the question of the psychosomatic method is a description in more detail of the physical aspects of the Jesus Prayer. Specific recommendations that you might find interesting to look at on your own. Again, Bishop Kalistos makes the point that these are not in any sense obligatory or even normative, and probably the majority of lay people do not emphasize this kind of, if you will, psychosomatic searching, this a deliberate effort to bend the body in such a way as to allow the mind to enter the heart, and then in a kind of a, one might even say, childlike physical way, based on a kind of a false physiology, entering the mind to enter what he calls the air of the heart so as to experience eventually the light that somehow dwells there. There's a kind of an expectation that the Jesus Prayer, if practiced long enough, if practiced correctly, will necessarily lead to the experience of indwelling light. That, I think we would have to admit, different from the notion of the gift God gives of the experience of contemplation that is entirely a gift and not the result of effort and not necessarily the result of practice. Practice can predispose one to being aware of this when the gift is offered, but there tends to be in this psychosomatic, or if you will, a spiritual, physiological approach to the Jesus Prayer, much more of an expectation that the physical practice will result in this experience of theosis, of divinizing light. And from that that perspective, it's understandable that we would have some reserve in regard to it. If we drop down to the list just above the section that describes the darkened cell, there are 7 aids that are described, especially useful to beginners. The first is what we would call a chaplet, or a kind of a paternoster, a rosary-like set of, not usually of beads, but more commonly of of knots in a cord that allows one to remember how many times one has prayed the prayer, the use of prostrations and metanis or bows, keeping the eyes closed. There's a practice that's described particularly toward the end of this text of placing the left hand on the chest and somehow localizing or making physical a sense of one's descent of the mind into the heart, being in a darkened, enclosed room, sitting on a low stool, and what we might even found a little amusing, when things get too warm, when one experiences too much of this warmth, cooling oneself with water or applying towels soaked in water. Again, there is a very strong physical and even physiological sense of the effect of this this kind of praying. And there is then a description of each of these particular activities. The section on breathing is of some interest, perhaps because of its similarity to breathing exercises that are found in other religious traditions, although one has to be very cautious about describing them as being the same or exactly parallel to what one finds in yoga and elsewhere. And finally, I would just like to mention a section that requires us to go back again to that first section on the question, does the Jesus Prayer replace other prayers? And perhaps we can conclude with the portion that comes just before the second section in the psychosomatic method. We find a recommendation that the Jesus Prayer can be used during the Liturgy of the Hours, during the office, and ideally this is better than using it to replace them. This is a skill and a talent that is quite normal, to be able to use monologistic prayer in a non-disturbing way during a liturgical experience where one is praying with others. And right now, this is politically incorrect in the Roman Catholic Church. There are quite a number of priests and liturgists who will be horrified at the thought that someone would dare to do monologistic prayer during their liturgical celebration. And so they will scowl and be unhappy with people who are, say, praying the rosary or engaging in any other kind of devotional prayer during the celebration of the Eucharist. And I'm not saying that that should be a norm or should be a preferred, but it's quite understandable that there is a way of using monologistic prayer that does not detract from one's experience of liturgy, but may well enhance it. And this is something that is perhaps better understood in the Christian East than in the present Christian West, although I think it was very well understood in the West some years ago. And I would hope that over time we can begin to allow a broader understanding of how this kind of prayer can be used, both as private devotion and also perhaps as a way of allowing oneself to gently focus on and experience smaller bite-sized aspects of what happens during liturgical prayer. I think there's a great deal of wisdom in this tradition which we have yet to properly appropriate, and which perhaps many folks who have a longer experience of praying in liturgy than some of those who would criticize them for attempting to do monologistic prayer during liturgical celebrations needs to be brought to the fore and needs to be heard.